Episode 7, The First Hidden Lesson of School, Obedience is a Virtue. Critical thinking question, why is obedience actually the opposite of virtue?
Obedience is the very best way to show that I believe. The one is of what the Lord commands. Doing is joyful ease. Action is the key. Doing immediately. Joyful will we see. Obedience is the very best way to show that I believe. O-B-E-D-I-E-N-C-E. Obedience is the very best way to show that I believe.
Slaves built the pyramids. Slaves built the Parthenon. Slaves built America. Slaves, this is your song. Thank you. Slaves. Thank you. Slaves. Thank you. Slaves. This is your song, thank you.
Welcome to episode 7 of School Sucks Podcast. Today's show is entitled The Hidden Lessons of School Part 1, Obedience is a Virtue. So this week we will pick up right where we left off in the previous episode, and we will begin identifying and then deconstructing the lessons that I believe are embedded into the curriculum of the public education system in America and probably around the world. The most important of these lessons is the idea that obedience, really blind obedience or unquestioning obedience to authority, is somehow virtuous. This is one of the most dangerous ideas that human beings have ever been tricked into believing. Time and time and time and time and time and time again, very evil people have received a great deal of empowerment from the unquestioning obedience of good people. That's basically the story of human history. Not the entire story, but a good piece of it. And just as it is with absolutely horrific state violence, obedience serves as a foundation that other things, other bad things, can be built upon. And that's basically how it works in public education. I consider this idea that obedience is virtuous as the foundational lesson upon which several other very destructive lessons can be built. Now, I've decided that the best way to deal with this topic would be to relate to you an experience that I had this past Saturday, and this sort of expanding web of ideas that experience subsequently led to. I was in Exeter, New Hampshire, and I was teaching a class for the SAT, and I was working with a group of students on the math problems, or the types of math problems that appear on this test. And this is not a test of knowledge or concepts that students should be aware of going into their senior year in high school, as much as it is a test of critical thinking and logical reasoning skills, which is why so many students do so poorly on it. I mean, after all, things like critical and creative thinking and the ability to distinguish logical arguments from illogical ones really just aren't items on the menu of garbage that you are force-fed during 12 years of public education. So on this past Saturday, I'm working with these kids on the SAT. I was giving them strategies for how to approach problems critically and creatively, and then how to deal with them logically. And in the middle of this exercise, one of the students spoke up and said, you know, I just was not taught to think like this. I was taught that here's a problem, here's a formula that I can use, I put them together, and I get a solution. Well, that to me sounds a lot like an assembly line process. You take one thing, you take another thing, you stick them together, and you move on to whatever's next. That is not critical thinking. That is not logical reasoning. Children are being trained to think like factory workers on an assembly line. And these are honors level, AP level kids. Now, judging by this student's facial expression, by his body language, by his tone of voice, it was clear that he was frustrated when being confronted with math problems where the best approach was for him to think about them critically, where a clear path to the solution wasn't being laid out by some sort of expert or authority. It almost seemed like a small crisis, and the other kids agreed with him. And that's really the nature of school. Not only does it train us to learn how to be told what to do, it teaches us how to want to be told what to do. And this experience that I had on Saturday was a good example of how this lesson is delivered in such a subtle way to these kids. It reminded me of something that I had read years ago. And I had forgotten I had read it, but seeing that, having this experience this past Saturday, brought it right back to the front of my mind. And I went home after the class, I started looking for this book. It was a book by another former public school teacher whistleblower named Jonathan. Last week we talked about Jonathan Taylor Gatto. This gentleman's name was Jonathan Kozel. And the title of this book, so appropriately named, The Night is Dark and I Am Far From Home. Now, I don't know what Kozel meant when he wrote that title down. I always interpreted it two ways. The night is dark. As far as knowledge is concerned, knowledge being light, illumination. And as far as illumination, I'm not talking about like a mystical, ritualistic, let's put on creepy masks and hump illumination. I'm talking about enlightenment. And I'm far from home. If home is the true self, a life of self-esteem, self-respect, and self-actualization, you're pretty friggin' far from home when you're done with public education. The third chapter in this book deals exclusively with the topic of obedience. And the experience that I had this past Saturday teaching this SAT class brought the first paragraph of that chapter, like I said, right back to the front of my mind. The chapter starts with a quote by George Bernanos, and it goes, "There is a constant increase, a stupendously rapid increase, in the number of obedient, docile men," unquote. Now, if you think about the people that I read all those quotes from in the last episode, they would be thrilled with this report from Bernanos, assuming that he wrote that down somewhere after the 19-teens or 1920s. The chapter begins. This is that first paragraph. "In the public schools of Boston, as in many other cities, there is a verse which, for long decades, was recited by all children in the course of character education. Every day, in every way, it is our duty to obey. Those who do not learn this verse today learn others like it. Those who do not learn it from verse learn it in other ways. But all young men and women who submit to schooling learn it, somehow." Sure enough, these students that I was working with on Saturday had learned it. A little bit further along in the chapter, Kozel writes, "The bias is not just to go along with things, but in particular, to go along with anything that is already set in motion when we get there. Since almost everything appears in operation, buildings rising, factories humming, planes flying, government functioning, at the time the child arrives, the teacher is in fact endorsing the political and moral status quo. But he does not wish to state it in this way. Instead, he offers only good-natured and, it seems, unbiased point of view. It is a good thing to be positive. It is not a good thing to be negative. In application, this involves both child and teacher right away in the positive affirmation of a large and murderous industry of war, an ongoing situation of starvation, malnutrition, retardation of poor children, Medical Havoc in the Northern Ghettos in the Rural South, A Simulation of Democratic Options by The Ritual of Meaningless Election Choices Between Candidates of Virtually Identical Position. The point is that it asks no courage, no conviction, no decision to say yes to processes like these. They are already in existence. In effect, then, what school approves as an affirmative approach is pretty much the sort of thing that we can do quite well while we are sleeping. The symmetrical opposite, the negative approach, is viewed by public school as either reckless or uncivilized. Let's not be negative and hostile. Let's not indulge in unconstructive criticism. Let's try to find the good points in the story. From this, it is a short step to a more important and more dangerous idea. This is the idea that we not only should not, but do not possess the moral right to break down any structure, any system or machine until we are ourselves in a position to construct a working model of our own conception. It isn't right to knock things down, the teacher says, unless we are prepared to put up new things in their place. It doesn't take much courage to attack what other people do or say, the teacher says. The hard thing is for us to offer something better. A great many people have worked for a long time to write these stories down for us, Susan, and draw these illustrations, and to print this book. It is very easy for you to criticize their work without suggesting an alternative. Now, this subtle lesson obviously provides a fine example of how government and its institutions can be perpetuated, and how people can tacitly accept the role of imposed authority in their life. So it serves that purpose for the state. But the title of this chapter in Kozel's book is Saying No. And rereading it for the first time in several years led this web of ideas I was talking about to expand to the work of a psychologist named Nathaniel Brandon, and the realization that this lesson is even more destructive than just for the purpose of perpetuating government institutions. Nathaniel Brandon was well known for his work on the topic of self-esteem and its general importance to a person's mental health. Really, essentially, being able to deal with reality and a person's internal reality in a non-contradictory and unclouded way. In 1994, he wrote a book called The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem. These six pillars were 1, the practice of living consciously, 2, the practice of self-acceptance, 3, the practice of self-responsibility, 4, the practice of self-assertiveness, 5, the practice of living purposefully, and 6, the practice of personal integrity. Training in obedience, the training that we get in our public education, encourages us to abdicate responsibility in all 6 of these areas. And what I had read by Kozel reminded me of that 4th pillar, the practice of self-assertiveness. We don't get the choice about saying no. And if we think about the things that go on in our world, aside from what Kozel mentioned, dealing with authority and state power, being trained that you don't have a moral right to say no, to refuse, to not cooperate, is a very, very dangerous and destructive thing. But fortunately, Nathaniel Brandon's work is just one piece, albeit an integral piece, of a larger philosophy that runs counter to this idea that obedience is virtuous. It's a philosophy that began to gain public attention, in the United States at least, in the 1950s. So from the SAT to the work of Jonathan Kozel, to the 6 Pillars of Self-Esteem by Nathaniel Brandon, let me expand this web of ideas one step further.
This is Mike Wallace with another television portrait from our gallery of colorful people. Throughout the United States, small pockets of intellectuals have become involved in a new and unusual philosophy which would seem to strike at the very roots of our society. The fountainhead of this philosophy is a novelist, Ayn Rand, whose two major works, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, have been bestsellers. We'll try to find out more about her revolutionary creed and about Miss Rand herself in just a moment. And now to our story. Down through history, various political and philosophical movements have sprung up, but most of them have died. Some, however, like democracy or communism, take hold and affect the entire world. Here in the United States, perhaps the most challenging and unusual new philosophy has been forged by a novelist, Ayn Rand. Miss Rand's point of view is still comparatively unknown in America, but if it ever did take hold, it would revolutionize our lives. And Ayn, to begin with, I wonder if I can ask you to capsulize. I know this is difficult. Can I ask you to capsulize your philosophy? What is Randism?
First of all, I do not call it Randism, and I don't like that name. Call it objectivism.
All right.
Meaning a philosophy based on objective reality. Now, let me explain it as briefly as I can. First, my philosophy is based on the concept that reality exists as an objective absolute, that man's mind, reason, is his means of perceiving it, and that man needs a rational morality. I am primarily the creator of a new code of morality, which has so far been believed impossible, namely, a morality not based on faith.
On faith.
Not on faith, not on arbitrary whim, not on emotion, not on arbitrary edict, mystical or social, but on reason, a morality which can be proved by means of logic, which can be demonstrated to be true and necessary.
All right.
Now, may I define what my morality is?
All right.
Because this is merely an introduction. My morality is based on man's life as a standard of value. And since man's mind is his basic means of survival, I hold that if man wants to live on earth and to live as a human being, he has to hold reason as an absolute, by which I mean that he has to hold reason as his only guide to action, and that he must live by the independent judgment of his own mind, that his highest moral purpose is the achievement of his own happiness, and that he must not force other people nor accept their right to force him, that each man must live as an end in himself and follow his own rational self-interest.
May I interrupt now?
You may.
Because you put this philosophy to work in your novel Atlas Shrugged.
That's right.
You demonstrate it in human terms in your novel Atlas Shrugged. And let me start by quoting from a review of this novel, Atlas Shrugged, that appeared in Newsweek. It said that you are out to destroy almost every edifice in the contemporary American way of life, our Judeo-Christian religion, our modified government-regulated capitalism, our rule by the majority will. Other reviews have said that you scorn churches and the concept of God. Are these accurate criticisms?
Yes. I agree with the facts, but not the estimate of this criticism. Namely, if I am challenging the base of all these institutions, I'm challenging the moral code of altruism, the precept that man's moral duty is to live for others, that man must sacrifice himself to others, which is the present-day morality.
What do you mean by sacrifice himself for others? Getting to the point.
One moment. Since I'm challenging the base, I necessarily would challenge the institutions you name, which are a result of that morality.
All right.
And now, what is self-sacrifice?
Yes, what is self-sacrifice? You say that you do not like the altruism by which we live. You like a certain kind of Ayn Randist selfishness.
I would say that I don't like is too weak a word. I consider it evil. And self-sacrifice is the precept that man needs to serve others in order to justify his existence, that his moral duty is to serve others. That is what most people believe today.
Well, yes, we're taught to feel concerned for our fellow man, to feel responsible for his welfare, to feel that we are, as religious people might put it, children under God and responsible one for the other. Now, why do you rebel? What's wrong with this philosophy?
But that is what, in fact, makes man a sacrificial animal. That man must work for others, concern himself with others, or be responsible for them. That is the role of a sacrificial object. I say that man is entitled to his own happiness and that he must achieve it himself, but that he cannot demand that others give up their lives to make him happy.
And
nor should he wish to sacrifice himself for the happiness of others. I hold that man should have self-esteem.
This 1959 interview with Mike Wallace was the jumping-off point, really, for half a century of Ayn Rand's name and her philosophy of objectivism being dragged through the mud in popular culture. Now, many people today who have heard of it, unfortunately, consider it to be the philosophy of apologizing or rationalizing being a selfish asshole. But this is far from the truth. The derision and the dismissal of objectivism and Ayn Rand, the messenger, are both very important to maintain the structures as they exist in society today. As Mike Wallace said at the beginning of the interview, her philosophy threatens to strike the root of that tree of evil that I'm always talking about, even though Mike Wallace referred to the tree as government and religion. Those foundations that we have to protect, that we have to maintain. It's our tradition, right? We can't question that. Now, I am not a worshiper of Ayn Rand. I do not feel that she got everything right. And as a matter of fact, Rand certainly failed to articulate a political philosophy that was entirely consistent with the objectivism that she was just speaking about. Her followers have also gone down the wrong path. But it's important that we look at her work not as a graveyard of ideas, but as a garden of ideas. And one really beautiful and essential thing that has grown in that garden is the philosophy of liberty that I discussed at the end of the fifth episode. While what Rand says might seem harsh, it might seem confronting, it might run against most of what we've been taught or trained to believe, I will tell you this from my own personal experience. When you do not put your own happiness first, when you do not put your self-esteem or your value as a human being above other outside interests, you are useless to other people. I've learned this lesson the hard way through professional failures, through relationship failures, and the embrace, the discovery and the embrace of her work and the subsequent philosophies that grow out of it led me away from sitting in my 18th year at a desk being told what to do by some authority figure at the front of the room in pursuit of my goal to enter the public education system and teach nonsense to passive children, to finding my own way to teach, a way that would promise more success and satisfaction, and most importantly, consistency with what I believe to be moral and virtuous. Now, I'm not Tony Robbins over here. As far as profession goes, as far as my personal life or emotional life goes, I certainly have a long way to go. But I am extremely confident that I am now on the right path. Now, building upon all of this, let's deal with that critical thinking question that I brought up at the beginning of the show. Why is obedience actually the opposite of virtue? And by that obedience, I mean obedience to authority, or blind obedience, or unquestioning obedience to people who are trying to impose their will on you. Here's a quote from the author and philosopher Ayn Rand. If I were to speak your kind of language, I would say that man's only moral commandment is, thou shalt think. But a moral commandment is a contradiction in terms. The moral is the chosen, not the forced. The understood, not the obeyed. The moral is the rational, and reason accepts no commandments. Now we see how the philosophy of liberty grows out of her ideas. In the philosophy of liberty, it's stated, virtue only exists when there is a choice, and obedience implies that there is no choice. So blind obedience or blind allegiance precludes the possibility of virtue. In other words, virtue implies that there is a choice to be made. Obedience implies that there is no choice to be made. This blind obedience to authority is an irrational form of self-sacrifice. And to expand on that idea a little bit, I want you to think about the impact of this obedience training on three values. The first is reason, the second is purpose, and the third is self-esteem. Now, why these three values? Well, as the proud owner of yourself, it is your responsibility to educate yourself, to direct yourself in life, and to find the appropriate motivation for that direction. No other human being on this planet can do any of those things for you. Your reason is your primary tool for obtaining knowledge. Now, we're misled into believing that things like public education or some textbook or even some really good book are tools for obtaining knowledge. But if you took the best book, the most educational book in the entire world, and you opened it up to the most valuable page, and you placed it in front of a horse or a banana or a vacuum cleaner, nothing would ever happen. But if you place it in front of a reasoning human being, like you, now a lot of things become possible. The knowledge that you obtain through your reason will produce something, and this will produce something of your choosing based on your values and your goals and your ambitions. The product is achieved through purpose. Purpose is that direction that we point ourselves in towards those chosen goals. And the self-esteem is the motivating factor. It's hard to move towards a purpose or move in a certain direction towards a goal or an ambition if you do not feel that you are worthy of achieving that goal. I believe, and I am certainly not the originator of this idea, but I believe that you need to start thinking about yourself more in terms of being a hero on a quest. And that quest is to achieve great personal success, to fulfill your individual potential. You do not live, you do not exist for anybody else's purpose, not 5% of the time, 10% of the time, 34% of the time, just on Mondays, just on Tuesdays. Whatever percentage of your time is devoted to somebody else's goals, when that person is a stranger who doesn't care about you, you are that percent a slave. You exist for your own purpose. We're also told that we need to sacrifice for a fantasy concept called the common good. There is no such thing as the common good. The common good is an umbrella term thought up by people who really hope that you never realize what I'm telling you right now, that you exist for your own purpose. Sadly, the kinds of people who don't want you to realize that you exist for your own purpose don't have to rely on hope. Throughout the annals of human history, these types of people, these megalomaniacs, have had reliable systems that they can employ towards their end. Throughout much of the last 2,000 years, the most reliable form of control has been religion. And in recent centuries, the utilitarian idea of ethics, the idea that it is the job of a small group of ruling elites to deliver the greatest good for the greatest number of people, has also done the job quite well. And by the job, I mean the job of fostering obedience in the masses, not the job of providing the greatest good for the greatest number of people. What usually seems to be the result, whatever the time or place, is predation and bloody warfare and self-sacrifice. And in the modern world, really in the last century, this idea that what is virtuous is self-sacrifice, uniformity, and compliance has been disseminated among the masses by government-run education systems. You see, despite all the progress, all the change, all the advancement that you've probably witnessed just in your own life in science, technology, communication, power changes never. Demented people seek power, they achieve power, they become drunk and more demented from that power. It does not matter what costumes they wear, what kind of chair they sit on, what kind of title they have for themselves, or what kind of pageantry or procedures they have to justify their attainment of that power over other individuals. It is uniform throughout time what power is and what power does. This kind of power is only possible through mass obedience. The training in obedience is the most essential lesson in the world to them, and the most destructive lesson in the world to you. I would like to read you something else, and after I read this, I want to take a look at those three values I mentioned and see what condition they are in after the 12 years of obedience training that we all go through has been completed. This is from Ayn Rand's novel, Atlas Shrugged. To live, man must hold three things as the ruling values of his life: reason, purpose, self-esteem. Reason as his only tool of knowledge, purpose as his choice of the happiness which that tool must proceed to achieve, self-esteem as his inviolate certainty that his mind is competent to think and his person is worthy of happiness, which means worthy of living. These three values imply and require all of man's virtues. That's the end of the passage. To maintain mass compliance, systems of power and authority are very adept at accentuating, exaggerating, and drawing attention to the illusory benefits of what they do, while completely obscuring the costs and the consequences. And the best example of this is in the individual. We accept the idea that our lives are good because of these kinds of systems, without ever realizing the opportunity cost of being forced to live under these systems. Thus, most people seem perfectly willing to trade reason, purpose, and self-esteem for the illusion of service and protection delivered by agencies that are brought into existence and then maintained by violations of their property rights and their self-ownership. After the completion of the obedience training that is necessary to live under and tolerate such an irrational and disrespectful system, reason is unnecessary. Other people will do a majority of your thinking on important matters for you. Purpose, that will be determined largely by others, and your self-esteem will be measured by your willingness to sacrifice the first two values for the sake of the fictional collective or common good. These are the aims of modern public education systems, and if we look at the people, the majority of people in the society that we live in today, we see that they have largely been achieved. Again, let me remind you of the writing of Alexander Inglis, and once again, here is how Gatto summed up the ideas that Inglis wrote about, the six purposes of modern schooling. Number one, the adjustive or adaptive function. Schools are to establish fixed habits of reaction to authority. This, of course, precludes critical judgment completely. It also pretty much destroys the idea that useful or interesting material should be taught, because you can't test for reflexive obedience until you know whether you can make kids learn and do foolish and boring things. Goodbye, reason. Number two, the integrating function. This might well be called the conformity function, because its intention is to make children as alike as possible. People who conform are predictable, and this is of great use to those who wish to harness and manipulate a large labor force. Goodbye, reason. Goodbye, purpose. Number three, the diagnostic or directive function. School is meant to determine each student's proper social role. This is done by logging evidence mathematically and anecdotally on cumulative records, as in your permanent record. Yes, you do have one. Goodbye, reason. Goodbye, purpose. Goodbye, self-esteem. Four, the differentiating function. Once their social role has been diagnosed, children are to be sorted by role and trained only so far as their destination in the social machine merits, and not one step further. So much for making kids their personal best. Again, goodbye reason, goodbye purpose, goodbye self-esteem. Number five, the selective function. This refers not to human choice at all, but to Darwin's theory of natural selection as applied to what he called the favored races. In short, the idea is to help things along by consciously attempting to improve the breeding stock. Schools are meant to tag the unfit with poor grades, remedial placement, and other punishments. Clearly enough that their peers will accept them as inferior and effectively bar them from the reproductive sweepstakes. That's what all those little humiliations from first grade onward were intended to do. Wash the dirt down the drain. Goodbye, self-esteem. And six, the propedeutic function. The societal system implied by these rules will require an elite group of caretakers. To that end, a small fraction of the kids will quietly be taught how to manage this continuing project, how to watch over and control a population deliberately dumbed down and declawed in order that government might proceed unchallenged and corporations might never want for obedient labor. That, Gatto continues, unfortunately, is the purpose of mandatory public education in this country. Now, when we look at all the things that government does and how bad it sucks at almost all of them, when it comes to public education and these stated goals, the government seems to really kick ass. But these problems, this obedience training, is not without solution, without course correction. And the first step towards that solution is the acknowledgement that this training has taken place in your life. I'll leave you today with one idea that hopefully will start you on this path if you are not already on it. You are not the means to somebody else's end. You are your own end. The end.